I'm Allison Kulo.
And I'm Doug Wells. Welcome to Mound Money on KPCW.
We are fully in the midst of Cold War II, this time with China. Taiwan is a new West Berlin, a perilous strategic flashpoint where localized events could trigger a devastating war between nuclear powers. But this outcome is far from inevitable. Laying out the comprehensive strategy for the U.S. and allies to avoid this fate, the highly respected security analyst Dmitry Alperovic reveals key actions that could enable America to win the race for the 21st century. This sharp, timely book is the essential blueprint for preventing a catastrophe. Dmitry Alperovic is an internationally recognized thought leader on geopolitics and national security and co-founder and executive chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator. He is also the co-founder of the leading cybersecurity company CrowdStrike. Alperovic serves on the Homeland Security Advisory Council of the Department of Homeland Security, as a founding board member of the U.S. Government's Cyber Safety Review Board, and has previously served as special advisor to the Department of Defense. Dmitry, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's wonderful to be with you today.
So you talk a lot about in the book how it's best to understand those that we are against, and that in the past we have failed to read nations correctly. How has America failed to read China correctly?
Well, for the past 40 years, we've been obsessed, of course, with trying to get to a better relationship with China through economic interconnections and trade, hoping that that would inevitably lead to liberalization of the political system and China abandoning its ambitions that it has had, of course, since the founding of the People's Republic of China and the communist takeover of mainland China to take Taiwan. None of that has happened. And in fact, the reverse. China today is more authoritarian than it's been in the last 20 years. Its military is the strongest it's ever been, and its ambitions to take Taiwan are now extremely acute.
So if we were to look closely, what is China's current geopolitical strategy?
Well, China sees itself as returning to what it believes is its rightful place as the world's most predominant superpower. For much of human history, China was the world's most richest and powerful country, in large part because of its population. And only in recent centuries, particularly with the onset of the Industrial Revolution, was Europe and then later America able to eclipse it, in part also because of colonialist efforts by European powers to keep China down, what China calls as a century of humiliation, starting in the 1800s. But now it sees itself as back. Its economy, it thinks, is going to eclipse the United States, I think wrongly, as I write in the book. But nevertheless, it believes that its economic power will drive its military power and will ultimately allow it to achieve a dominant position first in Asia and then globally.
So, Dmitry, I have a two-part question for you. You mentioned earlier the trade between the U.S. And China and how the U.S. was hopeful that that would bring democracy to China. That hasn't happened. But there is a positive to that, right? We do have these ties. It would be very painful economically for both the U.S. and for China if we were to escalate things beyond a Cold War. And so do you agree with that point of view that these economic ties do kind of quell things and give us a better hope for coming up with a diplomatic strategy for this?
Well, I think they can be helpful if used correctly and if we smartly try to de-risk on critical strategic sectors over which China can have leverage. Look, economic ties alone do not prevent conflict, as we've seen in numerous occasions throughout history. The most obvious example of that is Germany and the United Kingdom before World War I. Enormous economic ties, and some of them have actually continued even as they were fighting this brutal conflict on the plains of Europe. Russia and Ukraine obviously had enormous economic ties. Russia and the rest of Europe did not stop war there. So that's not enough. And if you look at what China has been trying to do, particularly accelerating under Xi Jinping's regime, is try to put forward a program that they call Made in China 2025. I suspect it will be pushed to maybe 2030 or 2035 because they're behind. But essentially achieve independence in critical sectors like semiconductors, like aerospace, like green energy, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, in order to have as much leverage over our economy as possible and at the same time diversify their trade to Latin America, to Africa, to East Asia, and Europe, to make themselves less reliant on the United States so that it would be less impactful by potential sanctions, by potential cutoff in trade. So they've been pursuing this strategy, and I argue in the book that we need to start implementing our own version of that strategy that I call unidirectional entanglement. It is not about decoupling from China. That is not possible, nor is it desirable, because no economic ties absolutely don't give us leverage. But it's about tying China closer to us and making sure that they're more dependent on our economy, not less, and making, at the same time, ourselves less dependent in critical industries like semiconductors and critical minerals on China.
So if we are to look at where we are currently with China, you state that we're in a Cold War, Cold War II. Can you describe what makes us in a Cold War? And do we have to know we're in a Cold War to be in one?
Well, I do think that the first step is admitting the problem. And, you know, there are 11 other steps that you typically take, but you have to start there.
Program.
And, you know, if you realize that you are in a Cold War, which we did obviously in the 1940s, right after the end of World War II, then you can start building the grand strategy for how you win it. If you don't admit that you're in a conflict, then it's going to be hard to mobilize the domestic population, the political establishment, to actually come up with a strategy and implement that strategy for victory. But, you know, going into this book, I had a strong belief that we're already in a Cold War, but doing research as I did on the first Cold War, I was actually shocked by the number of similarities between the two conflicts. I assumed that there were some similarities, but largely the two conflicts were very different and similar way to the way World War II and World War I were very different conflicts, yet they were both world wars. But as we go through in the book with my co-author, Garrett Graff, we outline that on almost every point of the competition, we're facing very much similar threats. So it starts with global competition for supremacy. Not unlike the first Cold War, you have a competition between the United States and China that is not just playing out in the Indo-Pacific region, but also across the world, right? They're trying to get influence in Africa, in Latin America, in Europe, and in the region itself. That's quite obvious. Both countries are preparing for war, much as we did during the first Cold War. Both the Department of Defense and China are building up their militaries and engaging in arms race that would potentially see both militaries fight a devastating war in the region, potentially over Taiwan. There's also a nuclear arms race that is identical to what we've been facing in the Soviet Union days, where China right now is massively building up its arsenal, going from about 300 nuclear warheads that it has today to well over 1,000, as well as beefing up its ability to launch these weapons from missile silos, submarines, and bombers. And the United States is engaging in a modernization of its nuclear arsenal as well. There's a space race. Once again, as we did in the 1960s, there's a race to get to the moon. And put a man on the moon yet again, and now there's another race potentially over the next decade to get to Mars. And there's an ideological struggle. The ideological struggle is quite a bit different in that this is not a communism versus capitalist struggle that we saw during the first Cold War, but there's certainly an authoritarianism versus democracy struggle that, you know, even President Biden talks about all the time. And the Chinese are absolutely trying to build authoritarian alliances around the world, and there was even reporting the last couple of years about schools that they're opening up in Africa to teach leaders of liberation parties in Africa about how to run their countries, how to run their surveillance regimes that the Chinese are trying to export as well. And you also have a major regional flashpoint. So in the first Cold War, that was West Berlin, right? That was the for the first 15 years of that conflict, that was the place where the United States and Russia, or Soviet Union, were in great danger of going to conflict, including nuclear conflict. In today's Cold War, that is Taiwan. And then you also have a scramble for bases. You have the United States building up bases in the Philippines, improving its capabilities in Japan and Guam. And China is doing similar things with its own friends like Cambodia and Pakistan and Djibouti. And you have a spy war. In fact, the spy war that we're facing today, the espionage war, far eclipses, according to the director of the FBI, Director Wray, what we saw throughout the First Cold War, in part because of cyber, in part because of just the scale at which the Chinese are able to operate in terms of infiltrating our society, our companies, to try to steal both secrets and intellectual property. So in all of those levels, you have a very similar conflict play out. Now people often say, well, we have this great economic interdependence between the two countries, which you did not have to the same extent in the Soviet Union, Cold War. And that is absolutely right. The magnitude of trade with China, of course, is unprecedented in history. But as I highlight in the book, even on that point, there was quite a bit of trade, particularly in the early years with the Soviet Union. And throughout the entire Cold War, you had the Europeans actively providing loans to the Soviet Union that were essential to the survival of that regime. Much of the oil and gas industry of the Soviet Union that financed the regime and the arms race was running off Western technologies that was sold to them. And of course, they were exporting that oil and gas primarily to Europe, as well as wheat on occasion. So you've had a variety of economic connections even with the Soviet Union in the Cold War. Not quite at the same level as it is today, but certainly the similarities are there.
Okay, so you've given us a lot to unpack here. I want to go to Taiwan, because I think for many Americans, myself included, that is the most likely place where this goes from a Cold War to a hot war. And I think, as most Americans understand, you know, semiconductors are in everything. And all these semiconductors are made in Taiwan. So that's why Taiwan matters to us. But why does Taiwan matter so much to China? I understand there's the history there, the government being driven out during the Communist Revolution to Taiwan. But why is Taiwan so important to China?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I do have to argue a little bit with you that I think that Taiwan matters to the United States way beyond just semiconductors, but we can get into that maybe later. But to China, it matters for, I believe, five reasons. And it's actually interesting because those same five reasons, I believe, caused Vladimir Putin to invade Ukraine, a conflict that I predicted months before it happened. And those reasons are history. Xi Jinping has a distorted view of history. He believes that Taiwan belongs to China, even though, as I write extensively in the book, there's never been a moment in history when whoever fully controlled China also fully controlled Taiwan, not a single year. Similarly, in Europe, of course, Putin does not believe that Ukraine is a nation and has spoken a lot in recent years of how it belongs to Russia and has always belonged to Russia. Again, a completely erroneous reading of history. There's also a destiny. Both authoritarian leaders believe that it is both their country's destinies as well as their personal destinies to unify these breakaway lands as they see them with their effective empires, Russian Empire or the Chinese Empire, they believe these lands have always belonged to. But there's also a security and a geography reason as well that is very much rooted in real politique. So with Putin, for example, it is unmistakable that in Russia, before Putin and under Putin, they've always been concerned about invasions from Europe, from Napoleon to Hitler to the Poles and Teutonic Knights that have invaded Russia over the last 1,000 years. Most of these invaders have marched through Ukraine. So the Russians have always used Ukraine as a critical buffer state to give them time to mobilize and to defend Moscow. But also, of course, if you're projecting power from an offensive capacity, you want to have Ukraine so that you can be on the borders of Europe. And the same thing holds true in Asia, where if you look at the map of Asia, when China looks out at that map, it sees itself completely contained by U.S. military bases and U.S. allies. Starting from the east, they're looking out at the Korean Peninsula, half of which South Korea, of course, is hosts to major component of U.S. military, almost 30,000 American troops that are based there, radar capabilities, bombers, and the like. Going further down is Japan, enormous presence of American military that is getting increased in recent years. Taiwan is next, and it's the anchor point of what is called the First Island Chain. And ability to take Taiwan allows you to escape from that containment would allow you to also project power offensively across that entire region. And of course, the other part of that containment circle is the Philippines, where the United States is once again putting U.S. military on those islands for the first time in over 30 years. So for all those reasons, when China thinks about itself from a defensive perspective, where the U.S. Navy right now and U.S. allies can essentially contain all trade going to China through those choke points, maritime trade, and is going to be able to stop the Chinese Navy from dominating the region, taking Taiwan would change that entire strategy. And then if you take Taiwan, if you're able to project your power across the Western Pacific, you're able to endanger the Japanese, you're able to endanger the Philippines, and you're able to push the U.S. Navy far out of that region, all the way to Hawaii. So from both defensive and offensive perspective, Taiwan is a critical strategic point for you. And the last reason, and which is why I'm concerned about this conflict in the next 4 to 8 years, is ego. I believe President Putin launched his devastating war in Ukraine because he wanted to be the one to go down in the history books as the person that brought back, in his view, these lands back to Russia. And similarly, Xi Jinping wants to do this under his own watch. In fact, he's often talked about how this is not a conflict that you can pass on to future generation. It has to be resolved now. Well, both leaders are in their 70s. And Xi Jinping is likely to get another term in office in 2027, a five-year term that will likely end in 2032. He'll be 79 then. Unlike our system, they don't tend to elect their leaders into their 80s in China. So it may very well be his last term. So he very likely is looking at this as something that has to be done in that time period.
Okay. And if I could just briefly ask you, you shared that for the United States, Taiwan is strategic for more reasons than the semiconductors. You spoke about the Chinese Navy. Was that what you meant, why Taiwan is so much more important to the U.S. than semiconductors? Or is there something else that we need to know?
Yes, absolutely. So the geopolitical position of Taiwan is absolutely essential to China, which is why it is also essential to the United States. In fact, General Douglas MacArthur in 1950 said that Formosa, as Taiwan was called at the time, is the unsinkable aircraft carrier, articulating its importance to U.S. military strategy in that region of Asia. And of course, at that time, semiconductors weren't even really a thing in the global economy. So the challenge for us and the challenge for China is that whoever dominates Taiwan is going to be able to project power across the region, is going to establish himself as the dominant power as the U.S. is today. And if we allow China to do that, it will be the most dominant power in the most important region of the world, the region where you have 50% of the world's GDP, most of the world's supply chains, most of the economic growth in the world. And this is not a hypothetical situation. I mean, I've had conversations with senior officials in the region that have told me that if Taiwan falls to China, regardless of how, whether the United States chooses not to fight for it, whether the Taiwanese decide to fall to Chinese coercion on their own, that will change everything for them. That will mean that China will be the big sheriff, the big bully in the region, and they will have to accommodate them to a much greater extent than they do today, and the U.S. influence will wane.
So within this interview, we only have a few minutes left, and one of the things I thought was really important in the book is how you stated that we're entering a period that may last as little as 30 years before China's demographic and economic challenges overtake its apparent success. China is weaker than we think. Why is it important to understand this?
Well, absolutely, because at the end of the day, Chinese strategy depends on its economic dominance. And if it's not going to be able to eclipse the United States economy, as has been wrongly assumed for the last 20 years, then that changes everything for them. And right now, we're seeing the fundamental weaknesses in their economy. They've reached the middle income trap. Their growth is stagnating. On top of that, they have huge economic challenges with their real estate bubble, with their youth unemployment touching on 15%. And they're going to be experiencing over the coming 30, 40 years an enormous demographic collapse. They're going to go from 1.4 billion people they have today to as little as 550 million by the end of the century, a collapse that has been unseen in modern human history. And of course, that collapse will mean lower productivity growth, lower economic growth, and lower ability to spend on national security issues and military buildups that will allow them to dominate that region. So if we can wait them out, if we can deter them from invading Taiwan and establishing the rules of the road in the most economically important region of the world, we can absolutely win the Cold War too.
We don't have a ton of time to be able to go into the second part of the book, which is a lot of tools that talk about how we can specifically address with international partners how to kind of keep China at bay. But the one thing I wanted to hear from you directly is that while the book outlines a game plan for victory, I want to hear how the U.S. can develop a national strategy that can withstand new presidential administrations.
Well, that is really the key question in the book, because as I argue, we have all the tools and all the advantages to win this Cold War, just like we won the first Cold War. The big question mark is, do we have the political will? Now, during the first Cold War, of course, we've had numerous Democratic and Republican administrations that essentially followed the same strategy of containment, deterring Soviet expansionism, deterring conflict, and ultimately outlasting them. Do we have the wherewithal, the patience, and the time to do that with China? That is a question that we will find out in the coming years.
I've truly enjoyed the book. We've been speaking with Dmitry Alperovic. He is the author of World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. Dmitry, this is a fantastic book. It's a great read. Thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks so much for having me.
Many parts of the world have successfully developed high-speed rail systems that serve millions of passengers every day and connect metropolitan areas and local communities across international borders. The United States has a history of large-scale public works projects, but we've yet to deliver the same achievement already witnessed in Europe and Asia. Last week, a groundbreaking event took place in the United for the United States' first high-speed rail project that will connect Las Vegas and Los Angeles. Is this the step to a future filled with more high-speed rail projects? Joining us this morning to help answer that question is President and CEO of the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, Andy Kuntz. Andy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So this train is heralded as the first high-speed rail in the United States. Because we don't have that here in our audience in the United States, help our audience understand what is considered high-speed rail.
High-speed rail is a complete system where it's special infrastructure built for high speeds. It's special lightweight trains and signaling and power systems to enable continuous operations of at least 186 miles an hour. And it's fully electrified and very highly controlled from control centers, so you can have trains every 3 to 4 minutes at those speeds. Very high capacity.
Yes, that sounds amazing. With regards to that, I often think that high-speed rail needs to have two faraway destinations. Are there typically stops along the way where the train has to slow down?
Well, they don't necessarily have to be faraway destinations, but they need to be kind of major metro areas, ideally 200 miles or more apart. But many of these around the world actually do make other stops in between, and not every train makes those stops. Like if you look at the London to Paris line, the majority of those trains are express trains, nonstop, but then in between those, they have a couple others that make a stop or two in between those major capitals. So they serve, what that does is it gives them flexibility to serve the high capacity, high corridor lines as well as smaller towns and cities along the way.
So this train's been talked about for decades, and so it's not a surprise to me that we finally had the groundbreaking. I am surprised, you know, there's a couple routes that have been talked about for high-speed rail. And the Los Angeles and Las Vegas section is so well served by air and car now. There's a great highway that goes through that. Frankly, I was surprised that this was the first high-speed rail we're going to have in the U.S. It's almost like, you know, it's a weekend getaway type thing. And so why do you think it was this route? Is it the territory? I've driven that route. I know there's a whole lot of nothing between once you get out of the Los Angeles basin until you get into the Las Vegas area. Was it because it was less expensive to build this rail? Or why is Los Angeles to Las Vegas the first high-speed rail in the U.S.?
Well, it's probably because it's one of the busiest corridors in the United States. I think there's something like 40 or 50 million people that travel between those metro areas. And so that's kind of a no-brainer for where high-speed rail would be highly successful. Whenever you have two endpoints with very high travel between those two points and the potential for even more travel. So when people have a 2 or 3 hour easy train ride, there'll be a lot more travel to Vegas and to Los Angeles. And remember, it goes both ways. Las Vegas people can go to Los Angeles for the weekend and go to the beach and visit, you know, sporting events and things like that. So we think it makes a lot of sense just because it is a very busy tourist corridor, and a lot of international travelers and many of them are used to using trains back in their home nation. So we think it'll be very highly successful and will help set the nation on a course of faster, better transportation for everybody and other corridors as well.
And Andy, can you give us a sense of where this route is specifically located and how much faster and better people can get between the two cities?
Well, it'll go in the median of the highway, so and it'll pull right into Las Vegas. They have a whole new piece of property where we were at the groundbreaking, where they're going to build a whole new development and probably casinos and sporting events and hotels and apartments and everything else. And it's right in the southern end of the Las Vegas Strip. And then it's coming into Rancho Cucamonga, which is the southern part of the Los Angeles region where it connects to Metrolink, which loops right on around into Union Station and connects into the whole metro system. And then eventually it's going to connect directly with the California High-Speed Rail Project, which is under construction already. That will connect from San Fran and Sacramento down to L.A., down to San Diego. And in L.A. and in Palmdale, the two systems will intersect, where the trains could actually go on each other's tracks. And so somebody could go from Vegas nonstop all the way to San Francisco, for example. And so it's going to really open up a lot of travel options for a lot of people.
So they could go nonstop from Las Vegas to San Francisco, but they'd have to take a regular speed train from Los Angeles to San Francisco. Is that right? Or are there...
No. California is building a high-speed rail system as well. That's been under construction for 9 years. So technically that was the first to get into construction. It's just a much more complicated and larger, you know, it's like 800 miles long, and they've got mountains to tunnel through. So it's a much more complicated project to build. But that's under construction, and so the two will meet, and you'll be able to go 200 miles an hour all the way from L.A. or from Vegas to L.A. to San Francisco and down to San Diego.
And how do ticket prices compare on high-speed rail compared to going by the airlines?
They're usually a lot cheaper than flying. If you look at Europe, who has a mature high-speed rail system, and they have several operators operating on those corridors, the ticket prices, we heard one lady just wrote an article recently in Spain, and she said she was looking into flying from Madrid to Barcelona, and the taxi from her house to the Madrid airport was going to cost more than the high-speed train from Madrid all the way to Barcelona. So the ticket prices are incredibly cheap in Europe, and that's what we're hoping will happen here once this becomes more of a mature system and there's multiple operators, and because they're very efficient systems to operate. So they can operate at a much lower cost than an airline can, and they can move thousands of people much more quickly and more efficiently than the airline industry can. So it will definitely be cheaper than flying.
And what about the amenities? I'm assuming that I may actually have more legroom on a train than in an airplane.
Well, actually, a standard seat on a high-speed train is about the size of a first-class seat on an airplane. not only the seat size, but the legroom size, the elbow room size, all that. That's standard seating on a train, on a high-speed train. And then you have all kind of other amenities. You have USB ports and plugs and lights, and usually there'll be you can watch movies in the screen in front of you, and you can order food to your seat. They have all kinds of gourmet food on the trains and wines and drinks and stuff. So these are luxury transport modes, but at affordable prices that everybody can afford.
So if I'm correct, most of passenger rail today is done by Amtrak, which is subsidized by the U.S. government. Can you talk to us about how are the tracks themselves being paid for, and then how is the operations of the trains going to be paid for? Is that going to be a public-private cooperation, or is that going to be completely private?
Well, we have several options taking shape as we speak. The California system is a publicly led project being led by the state of California with public dollars. But in their legislation, it was written that the train operations for that system will be a private operator. So they will have, somebody will win a concession to operate the trains under the rules and regulations of the state who's building the system and who will own the system. In Nevada, the one that just had the groundbreaking, that's a mostly private system, although it's becoming more of a public-private partnership. Those will be operated by Brightline, which is a private company, and they also have a slower speed system that's already been up and running between Miami and Orlando. Has proven to be extremely highly successful. They've had to double and triple the capacity and get more trains ordered and everything just to keep up with the demand. So we're going to have several models, but ideally the best model we've seen evolve around the world is for the tracks and the systems to be publicly owned and then for the operators to be private. And that's more or less how our aviation system works. It's how our highway system works. Those are all public infrastructure, publicly administered with private users using, like private airlines using the public airports. So we've got some good models between our current systems here and then how high-speed rail operates in a number of other countries around the world.
High-speed rail is increasingly discussed as a form of climate action. Can you discuss the difference between flying and taking a train?
Oh, it's a huge difference. It's something like 50 times less carbon per trip when you take the train, because these trains are all electric. And California and Nevada system both are going to be fully powered by solar and wind. California system, they're actually building their own solar collectors, miles of solar collectors and battery storage units. And so you're talking about an extremely green system, fully electrified, powered by renewable, compared to, you know, extremely energy intensive flying all powered by fossil fuels. I mean, it's just massive difference.
Yeah, no, that's a compelling argument. I'm curious why, you know, from your standpoint, the high-speed rail systems are starting first in the West. When we look at passenger travel, like the only time I've taken, this is bad, the only time I've taken a train is when I'm on the East Coast. And passenger rail is a way of life in the Philadelphia area and the New York City area, places like that. Why has high-speed rail not been rolled out on the East Coast in those highly congested areas?
It's the reason is partly what you're explaining, because those areas are so densely populated with cities, the train tracks are already heavily used. I think there's over 2,000 trains a day using the Northeast Corridor tracks. That just may all that together just makes it really difficult, because with high-speed rail, you have to literally build new tracks. And so you need a right-of-way to do that, and you need room to do that, and you need the willpower and the funding to do that. And, you know, almost none of those things have surfaced on the Northeast Corridor. Amtrak is under the thumb of Congress, and that's really difficult for them to take on some multi-tens of billions, if not $100 billion upgrade and new build of the Northeast Corridor when they've got $40 or $50 billion of basic repairs that are needed, and that's what they're doing now with some of this the recent money that was passed in the Infrastructure Act. So it's actually easier to build in a brand new place like in the Nevada desert than it is to try to build a new line right up through the Northeast Corridor where you've got obstacles at every turn. So the Northeast Corridor definitely should be upgraded to high-speed rail. The demand is there, the cities are there, the populations, the support rail systems, it's all in place ready. But it's going to take a somewhere else to make the case and show how great this is in America. And then I think the Northeast Corridor will begin. They've done studies, but it's just a huge undertaking to try to build something like that in an already congested place.
I've been in Utah through the 2002 Olympics and now the hope to be able to get a future Olympics. And when I saw that the train line was moving forward, I was wondering if there was a connection with the new passenger rail and LA hosting the 2028 Summer Games, because I always think of infrastructure improvements and the Olympics as kind of hand in hand.
Yeah, they do tend to incentivize and get people moving on stuff. The good thing is that's actually giving the Brightline West, the Nevada to LA project, they're an incentive to move fast. Their goal is actually to have it completed in time for the Olympics, and they're hoping to even have some of the Olympic Games take place in Las Vegas, and some of it even on their property, the things that they're going to be building in the next 4 years. So it's good that they're under a gun like that, so they're going to be really moving as fast as they can. They're talking about building a mile of track a day once they get the base infrastructure cleared and ready to go. So a number of our members are going to be the ones building it, and they've been actually strategizing for 4 or 5 years now of how they're actually going to accomplish that much new construction through not necessarily easy terrain. I mean, you're out there in 110 degree deserts, you're going to have to go through the mountains, and so it's not exactly easy to build, and you have to bring supplies and workers out there, and so it's going to be a challenge, but we think they're up for it. Brightline is a very organized company. They've already shown that they can deliver a project in Florida against lots of odds, and so we're pretty excited that this is underway now.
Yeah, so we have the infrastructure of the rail itself, and then we have, you know, when the passenger gets there. And you're going to be surprised because we have some parallels here in our little town of Park City, which is we have a free bus system for everybody that comes to town. But one of the challenges is, you know, the parking for getting people that, you know, out of their cars and onto the system. And I think of, you know, when you're in Las Vegas, for the most part, you really don't need a car if you're a visitor and you're there to do tourist things. But when you're in Los Angeles, you kind of do need a car, at least now. Are there plans to make it easier for people to travel without a car? So they take high-speed rail to Los Angeles, but then what do they do? Have you heard of any plans to support the infrastructure there, maybe expand the busing system? Is Los Angeles looking at this as maybe a catalyst to ramp up their metro offering?
Yeah, it's a good question. The state of California is actually ramping up all of their rail systems in preparation for this. They've been investing in the LA Metro system. They've been investing in Caltrain. They've been investing in, doubling the size of all those stations so that there's easy transfers from the high speed to the other trains. And so, it's L.A. is a major car culture, as we all know, but the rail systems are taking shape rapidly, and so it's going to be a combination of things. There's going to, you know, local rail will be upgraded to meet this, and it'll be coordinated with the train time, so when your high-speed train arrives, the other trains are right there ready. You don't have to wait another 20 minutes to get on the other train. There'll be rental cars. There'll be taxis, Ubers, bike share. And then the other big thing is a lot of these new stations are actually creating entire dense walkable communities from scratch around the station. So some people can just walk out of the train station and walk to their apartment or walk to their office building. So the idea is that, you know, you break up all the people that are coming in. Some of them can walk to their destination. Some of them will have to rent a car. Some will get picked up by somebody. Some will take a bicycle. Some will hop on another rail system. And if we get all those ramped up accordingly, then this should be pretty smooth. Yeah. Brightline has already been offering, like, their own branded Uber-type service for people in Miami. So if you want to, I don't know which class of tickets that is included in, but some of them you can buy a ticket and an Uber will pick you up at your house, take you right to the train station, and then you just hop on the train and go from there. So I think you're going to see a lot more of that kind of activity take shape as these unleash and millions of people are riding, because there'll be such a demand for, they call that the last mile. It's to the station and from the other station, so you need it at both ends. And then, you know, the bike share and the scooters are really now kicking in all over the country and getting heavy used, and those are perfect last mile things, especially if it's only a few blocks. Like, you hop off the train, grab a scooter, go 2-3 blocks, and you're at your destination.
Well, you've whetted my appetite to travel and to do the Las Vegas, the Los Angeles, a high-speed train when it's ready. I'm truly excited for what this could be. I'm looking forward to having this brought to the United States. We've been speaking to the president and CEO of the U.S. High-Speed Rail Association, Andy Kuntz. Andy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Park City-based Redhead Marketing and PR was founded in 2010 by Hillary Ryder Azzaretti. Redhead Marketing and PR is a contemporary boutique agency that specializes in public relations, marketing, and branding. One unique service that Redhead Marketing offers is the managed national corporations PR here in Utah. And Hillary Ryder Azzaretti is going to join us this morning to share about this relationship and whether it's common for large corporations to work with local PR agencies to hone their message to the local community. Hillary, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Doug and Allison.
So I know we have big things to talk about today, but I want to go to the origin. You started Redhead Marketing in 2010. What were you hoping to accomplish when you started that?
Well, essentially, I wanted to offer an alternative to the traditional multi-layered agency structure that was very predominant at that time. It was also the depths of the recession and a very pivotal time in marketing when social media was really coming on the scene and digital advertising, Google Ads, that was all very new in the marketing space. And I think marketing as a discipline became a lot more fragmented. And so you had freelancers who were maybe offering one service out there. And I wanted to offer a more holistic, comprehensive approach to clients without the layers of a big agency. And that really just has allowed us to be much more of a partner to our clients and part of their teams. And many of our clients don't even have marketing departments, and we kind of fill that role for them.
So one of the things that your agency is able to do is you work with large corporations and help them give a more local flavor to their messaging. Is that something that is one unique for PR agencies to do? Did you know about this type of thing when you got into the PR and marketing space?
Well, when I started, like a lot of other businesses, our focus was really on a lot of small independently owned mom and pop businesses. A lot of our clients were here in Park City, and we were helping them with their social media and their websites and their PR. But as our business has grown and we've become more known, we have been contacted by both national brands as well as national PR agencies representing those brands who are looking for a more localized approach in the markets that they're entering.
So these companies already have their own marketing either teams or firms or something like that, but what those firms don't have is the knowledge of the locality.
Right, in terms of the culture, the community, the media contacts. I mean, if you're a big corporation, you're very focused on national PR strategy. You're not going to have media contacts in Salt Lake City necessarily. So, for example, the TV show The Friends has a touring immersive exhibit, The Friends Experience, that hits different cities around the country. And when they came to Salt Lake at the end of last year, their Chicago-based PR agency engaged us to spearhead the influencer marketing and public relations here in Salt Lake.
So that's a great example where it makes a ton of sense to, you know, understand the local community, right? Because you've got this local experience and you're trying to drive people to the local experience. What about national brands? What are some examples of how you have to tweak their message to make a national brand's message, you know, maybe it's an online purchase or something, but what are examples of how they might tweak their message to better relate to our local community?
Well, for example, if you have a brand that maybe sells alcohol in one state, but not in Utah, so...
That's a great example.
Costco, for example.
Things are very different here.
Right,
yeah.
Costco or CVS, I mean, their messaging has to be tweaked here because their product offering may be different here. There are also certain cultural sensitivities in Utah because of the dominant religion here. So sometimes messaging has to be tweaked for that audience. Or maybe it's a client that is targeting that audience specifically, but they don't know anything about the LDS culture. And so they need a local voice to reach out to some of those media outlets.
I've been listening to an ad that talks about, it's like a national bank, and it's like, what Utahs love most is a great hike, you know? And you're like, okay, someone told them Utahns like to hike.
Right.
You know, but I would assume that you're getting a little bit more specific than what should we say what Utahns like most.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so many misperceptions about Utah nationally, right? I mean, just like maybe there are misconceptions about New York or Boston or other cities. And so just that localized knowledge and how to speak to the community in a certain voice and tone is really important. And a big national brand, they can't have that in-depth knowledge about every market that they're in.
So Hillary, I've been doing this show for 15 years now. And
that's
I think we had you on. Hopefully I don't look that old. I think we had you on when you first launched your company. And as you said, social media was a big thing. The Google ads were a big thing. You just a few minutes ago mentioned influencer marketing, which I assume is like YouTube and Instagram, influencers, people that have channels. What are some things that are happening now that local businesses should know to maybe improve their marketing?
Well, I think the real emphasis with social media these days is authenticity. And so with influencer marketing, we encourage our clients to partner with influencers who are likely to purchase their product or consume their product. And it's very important for those influencers to maintain trust and loyalty amongst their followers, that they're partnering with brands that their followers would respect and be interested in and wanting to learn more about. So I would encourage any business, local or otherwise, to really find your voice, understand who your followers are, and that you don't need to be on every social media platform. You really need to be on the number that you can manage and where your followers are most likely to be.
I'm nodding my head a lot on that one because I think a lot of times in my business aspect of my life, everyone's like, but why are we not on this? And how about this? And it's like, well, yeah, you want to make it more to you. You want to tailor it to what your business is.
Right. And you need a more streamlined approach to really be effective if you have limited resources. And, you know, if you are a brand that is catering to 65-year-olds, do you really need to be on TikTok? I mean, that's a whole other conversation. Are we going to have TikTok in another year or two in this country? But, you know, you really have to understand your demographic. And that's really where the brand strategy work that we do comes in, too, is understanding who your target audience is and how to message to them and what that awareness journey looks like for them to discover you.
Yeah, I'm curious. One of the questions I like to ask marketing folks has to do with what I call underpriced attention. There's many national brands that were really introduced and really got to the next level when, like, radio was first introduced because people didn't understand the power of it. And then television, McDonald's, Procter & Gamble really were built on the fact that those ads for national television were underpriced for a while. Same thing with social media, Facebook. There were these games, Farmville and others, that were able to get substantial followings at very low pricing. Is there any advertising, is there any avenue that you look at now that you say, people aren't using this enough, they should be using it more?
Well, in fact, there are forms of digital advertising that people aren't using enough. And, you know, we're seeing companies spend much more money on digital now than perhaps on television or print than, you know, who reads print anymore? Unfortunately, it's kind of gone by the wayside. So
digital is one of the areas that's still undervalued. Unfortunately, we need to leave it at that. We've been speaking with Hillary at Redhead Marketing. Hillary, congratulations, and thank you for joining us again. Thank you for listening to Mound Money. Please visit kpcw.org for more information.